Today on Maine Calling, the lure of modern video games. Chances are someone in your household is a gamer. It's estimated that more than 190 million Americans play video games. Almost half, women. There are a huge range of video games today. Some take advantage of cutting-edge technology to simulate real-world experiences. Some are played against strangers around the globe. Many are educational. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we dive into the virtual world of gaming. We'll discuss the reasons gaming is so popular and what these games mean for our culture. And we'll explore some of the worries about video games, from violence to social isolation. What's your favorite game? How do you talk about gaming with your kids? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to island and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Video games are everywhere. They've been made into blockbuster movies, can be found on smartphones, and are in most American homes now. Today, we're going to discuss the cultural impact of video games, this new world we live in. Joining me, Josh Rubin, affiliate researcher with Bates College. He'll be visiting assistant professor of anthropology at Colby College starting in January. He is the author of a forthcoming book on video game development called Feeding the Loop. And Rebecca Herzig is a historian of science and technology, a professor of gender and sexuality studies at Bates College, and co-editor of the book series, Feminist Technosciences. We invite you to join the conversation. Tell us about your favorite video game. Ask us a question. Maybe you're a parent and you want some guidance on how to talk to your kids. You can send that email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. So I'm so interested to talk to both of you. Josh, it occurs to me as I'm reading your title that you are an anthropologist, and yet we're talking about video games. And if that doesn't say it all about where we are, you know, how scholars of the future will study America of 2024, video games will be a part of that study, right?
Oh, no question about it. I think if you look at the world around you, everything has moved increasingly into a digital, interfacing with a digital world. And video games have only grown in impact over the past several decades. I think that it's going to be part of the cultural milieu for decades to come. And I like to think, well, people in the video game industry, the people who I work with, will say that video games are a young medium. They sort of had their founding moments in the late 1960s into the 1970s. And so it's roughly 50 years that video games have been developing. And if you think about something like film, getting its start in the late 19th century, film has been around for about 130 years. And so I think there are ways that this is not exactly accurate, but it's certainly true that video games are only beginning to develop and their cultural impact is only beginning to be fully realized.
Rebecca, who plays video games?
Shockingly, many more people than you might tend to think. The average age of the American gamer is 36. It's not 12 or 13, as we might have in our imagination. And roughly 30% of the gamers in this country are over 50. So it's not just young folks. It's definitely not just boys. It goes all across genders, all across regions, all across ages. There's some variation, of course, in which kinds of games folks are playing and on what kinds of platforms, who tends to use mobile gaming versus consoles, things like that. But yeah, no, it's ubiquitous, as Josh was saying. This is where the culture is going at this point.
Yeah, Josh, I read this morning more than 190 million Americans. In a country with 330 million, that's well more than half. Go ahead.
Right. So one of the things that the video that has happened in the video game industry is that the idea of who plays games has really been codified around a kind of identity of a person called a gamer. And I think that a lot of your listeners probably would bristle at the idea that they would be a gamer. But if you look at the kinds of games that they're playing, from Wordle to Bejeweled to various other kinds of games, they also play games. They are part of the wider landscape of games. And I think it actually does a sort of significant disservice to what video games are and how they're experienced to say that video games are about gamers and they're not about people playing all sorts of on their couch, on the train, on a bus, with family, with friends, that kind of thing.
Well, and if you think beyond just numbers of players, if you think about broader like economic impacts of the industry, it's immense. It's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. Last year, consumer spending on video games in this country was more than $53 billion. So that's more than Hollywood music combined, which is just a staggering fact, I think. And in terms of kind of their the way that they've kind of got tentacles in the rest of our lives, as Josh can say more about, there are now concerts online, there are lectures online in these video gaming spaces, and those are dwarfing kind of traditional in-person venues. So just over the weekend, Fortnite held a concert online. A lot of your listeners will be familiar with this. 14 million concurrent players were at that concert, the largest concert in the history of the country by a long, long way. And that's just the people who were there in the game. All kinds of other people were streaming it on Twitch or on YouTube and so on. So absolutely enormous in terms of their cultural footprint.
So they were playing the game, and part of the game was being at a concert. Yes.
Yes, yeah. With Snoop Dogg was the opening act, but they had several others, including an artist who's no longer with us, Juice WRLD. But they had a kind of, avatar there, performing. And you can watch parts of it online if you weren't there live, and it's just incredible. And you can see the energy of the players there together dancing as though they were at an in-person concert. They were in person. They were just in person, virtually. So.
Okay, we're going to put a link to that on our Facebook page. Josh, I'm going to ask you this though. There remain, even though this is a brave new world, it's 2024, there are still only 24 hours in a day. So, what are we doing when we're gaming? What are we replacing? Are we not watching movies? Are we not reading books? Are parents thinking my kids are not studying? Are we not watching TV? What is gaming replacing?
I mean, I think the classic kind of argument that people make is if you're not gaming, or if you're gaming, you're not outside playing or something like that. But I think what's really interesting is games, as we've sort of already kind of mentioned, paint with a really, really broad brush, right? Games can be, I think, quite harmful. Games can be quite delightful, right? And so to say games are a kind of monolithic fixed category, I think, is to miss sort of recognize their not only their broad significance, but the way that they can impact us. And so, for example, just like if games, for example, are replacing TV that maybe a young person shouldn't be watching, that's not necessarily a bad thing if the games that they're playing are actually like quite uplifting and quite rewarding and quite self-actualizing. And so as to the specific numbers of what exactly is getting replaced, I'm not so sure about that. But it is true, to Rebecca's point, that a lot of the things that people were going to do are moving into digital spaces. And I think it's interesting to think about, it's still live. It's just live in perhaps a different way. And there are kinds of complexities about what it means to interact in digital spaces that I think probably Rebecca can speak very well to. But it's notable that these things are still happening, and you can still, in fact, be quite social and quite interactive in a game space, even if you're not like playing outside, like playing stickball in the street or something like that. Some idyllic kind of
And
image.
right, you're talking about the interactive, and I think a lot of people might think about two people sitting on a couch, two, teenage boys sitting next to each other with a PlayStation playing a game, but the interactivity can be with other players around the world, right, Rebecca?
Absolutely. And it turns out the data suggests that most of the online gaming is interactive in that way. So almost 75% of people playing are playing while they're connecting with other people, either in person on the couch in the way that you're suggesting, or with friends they know in real life, but then they're connecting with online. Some of them are with friends they've only made online. They'll never meet them. They're in another country. They're thousands of miles away. They're in a different time zone. But just as many people are playing with their significant others, with their kids, with their siblings, and so on. So a real way to build social connectivity in new spaces.
It's interesting because a lot of the game, the most popular game in the world is Minecraft, correct, Josh? Is that still the number one? Yeah, and with Minecraft, people are building things, correct? And they're really complicated and they take a lot of thought. And I saw this morning, supposedly the most popular game in Maine is a game in which somebody runs a farm, which is really interesting. And I guess I'm wondering if these are teaching us something or if they're really just silly.
Oh, I think they might seem silly, but in fact, I think that they have lots of really profound impacts from the perceptual to socialization, as we've been saying, but then also to sort of understanding a little bit more about how to interact with other people and how the world works. One of my favorite examples when I start to think about this is from an academic article, which I can sort of link to. Unfortunately, I don't have the article's name in my head at the moment, but I can pass it along after the show, which found that people who play games quite regularly will read screens differently based on the games that they play. And so that makes kind of intuitive sense. If you play games yourself, you'll know that you are kind of primed to look at information on screens in particular ways. But it's very clear that perceptually, these games are kind of educating us. But so too does using Excel, and so too does using Word, and all the regular kinds of software you might be more familiar with. But then there are also kind of all amazing impacts. I'm reminded of how in Minecraft, a group of incredibly intrepid, incredibly smart players built a computer in Minecraft that can play Minecraft. And so I want to be very clear that this doesn't mean that they were simply running the game through the computer, but rather they used the component parts that Minecraft makes available to you to build a functioning computer that then had a screen that would play Minecraft, and the little characters would jump around on a keyboard or on a controller to play Minecraft within the game itself. It's just unbelievable what people are doing. There's a really beautiful kind of crowdsourced creativity that happens in a game like Minecraft, where sort of like anything, all sorts of things are possible, and people can interact with each other in a lot of very new ways, but then a lot of very established ways too.
One of my favorite examples of that was during the pandemic, when designers built a Berkeley graduation in Minecraft. They called it Blockly, and thousands of people attended the UC Berkeley college commencement online in the Minecraft space. And if you can find it still, it's incredibly detailed. It looks, and all made out of these little blocky pieces that you have to work with in Minecraft. We haven't mentioned it so far, though, but both Josh and I are keenly aware that, social interactivity comes with its downsides too, right? So because these are human beings interacting in real time, you're going to get all the same kinds of issues that we have in non-gaming spaces, like discrimination and cruelty and exploitation and all those sorts of things. So we could talk more about that, especially if listeners want to call in and ask specific questions. But that's also part of it. Just because we're human beings in social spaces, we're going to have all the same issues of power and marginalization and so on.
And Rebecca, you read my mind, because I happen to know both of you are parents, and there are concerns. I know that many parents limit their kids' screen time is the word, but also worried about some games that seem to promote violence. So we'll start this conversation now. I'm sure it'll continue throughout the program. But Josh, you start. How do you, even though you are a student of gaming, you study it academically, you know everything about it, how do you talk to someone in the next generation about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good question. My daughter is 7, and one of the things that has been really important to me is to sort of meet her consciously in that world of games. I think I have so much advice. I don't quite know where to start. We have fortunately plenty of time to talk through it all. I think one of the best things that actually an adult can do with a child is to sort of come along with them on their adventures in games. I think that kids get very, very excited about games, and it's also very easy for adults to sort of nod along and go, But it does make a big difference, I think, if rather than just sort of nodding along, you say, show me, right? I'll sit next to you, show me this thing. And I think that that can have a tremendous impact on a possibility of connection, but then also a kind of awareness on the part of you, the adult, that you can understand this new medium. I think that there's a lot of anxiety about games, a lot of anxiety about people, about worlds moving in into virtual spaces. And I think those are very real, but at the same time, I would be cautious and I would caution people against sort of thinking that the best way to respond to that is to sort of close yourself off and say, I don't know what they're doing. I don't want to know what they're doing. It makes me uncomfortable. Give them their space or something like that. I think that there are certainly times to give children their space to play and to grow and develop. But I also think it's really valuable to sit next to them and sort of say like, wait, all right, so here's a good, I don't want to overdo things, but I'm playing a game with my daughter and there are goblins in the game. And the goblins, for some odd reason, have a Cockney accent. And so what I will do is I will pause the game and I will say like, Izzy, why do you think it is that the villains have this British Cockney, all of them have a Cockney accent? And then we'll think about it together and we'll start to realize that it's very odd that there's a kind of class component here that like the more elite you are in this game, the more refined your British accent becomes. And the more sort of like villainous you are, the more like kind of earthy and low class your accent is. And so we can begin to tease apart these things that kids aren't immediately going to realize about like, why are they conflating class with villainy in this world? Our world's class with villainy in this world. And that's the best way, I think, to bring kids into a realm of media literacy that they might not otherwise have.
Rebecca, you're nodding. Your son is older, right?
A little bit older, 13, yeah, so prime gaming years. Yeah, I think Josh and I are very much on the same page about this, in that you can see a lot of conversation both among parents and caregivers and educators, but also in journalism more broadly, that sort of swings between either a moral panic, these are going to kill our kids, it's going to destroy their futures, they need to be outside, their muscles are atrophying, you know, wherever that goes. Or on the other side, something that scholars might call like a techno-utopianism, where, you know, now that we're playing games, girls are going to learn how to code and we'll, you know, achieve a gender balance in computing sciences and, you know, all these sorts of things. And what I think we found, and what the people who research kids and digital experience have found, is that it's never just a straight either or. It's instead a how, right? Just with everything else. It isn't good or bad. It's how, and it's about context, and it's about attention to those contexts. So with a specific game, you might ask kind of more nuanced questions, like how is it commercializing my kid? How is the game making money off my kid? Where is the content that my kid generates going once it's been posted? Do I have control over that? Those kind of more detailed questions about the kind of situated nature of the game, rather than just am I pro games or anti games.
Rebecca, if someone's listening to this and thinking, oh my gosh, where do I start? I don't even know anything about games. Is there a place a parent can go to find answers to these questions?
Absolutely. My favorite spot, and Josh will jump in here too, is Common Sense Media. Just brilliantly detailed reviews of specific games that kind of rates them across particular categories like violence, like cursing, like commercialization. You know, what kind of messages are they pushing, and how are they engaging kids, or and so on. So I really can recommend that site. But there's also other forms of kind of parent reviews easily available online. So if your kid suggests interest in a particular game, you can always start looking around to see what other parents or caregivers have had to say about that game. And that people are very frank. This was great up until here, and then it went really off the rails. I wish I'd known about it ahead of time, you know, that sort of thing.
Great. I'm going to ask you, Josh, to add to that after we go to a break. We are talking about video games on Main Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing the role video games play in our lives. With me, Rebecca Herzig, historian of science and technology and professor of gender and sexuality studies at Bates College, and Josh Rubin, currently an affiliate researcher with Bates College, soon to be visiting assistant professor of anthropology at Colby College. Share your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Josh, before the break, something just happened on my screen. Before the break, Rebecca had mentioned Common Sense Media is a great place for parents to go. What would you add to that?
I think that's a great resource. The thing that I would say too is there's no substitute for your own sort of experiential presence in this world, just to reiterate that. So for example, a website can list category, like rate games according to violence or something like that. But then you have to ask what qualifies as violence, what kind of violence is a concern for your family and what kind of violence is not a concern. Like, there's a game called Smash Brothers, which is a game where the entire Nintendo catalog of characters are available to you, and you basically bounce on each other and push each other off the map, and the way that you lose is you fall off the map and you disappear, and then you run out of lives, basically, in a kind of battle royale scenario. That game does have violence in it. People are hitting each other. Characters are hitting each other with hammers, and they're setting off little like cartoon bombs and things like that. So the question then is that violence? Is that a kind of violence that families should be concerned about? Or is that a kind of violence that is not so concerning relative to the reality, the realism of a different kind of game? And I think that in that kind of context, there's really no substitute for sitting next to a young person and being like, what are you playing? What's the goal here? What are you trying to learn? What are you trying to accomplish? What's the goal? And I think on that same note, I would ask listeners, what's stopping you from doing that? Is it that you are sort of, your heart begins to flutter at the prospect of learning yet another new technology, as you may have experienced many over your life? Is it a matter of your taste, that you just, games are not for you, games are not the kind of thing you're interested in? Or is it a fear of failure? And I think that is very real. It's very hard to sit down as an adult next to a child, and you are the authority figure in their life, and you are going to lose when you play them in a game because they're very good and you're not very good.
That's okay. They're going to beat you at crazy eights and checkers too. So, you know,
exactly.
you're going to lose anyway. Rebecca, I wanted to ask you what we know. I know over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been so much concern about the link between violence and violent video games. Surely this has been studied in it's not just anecdotal. What do we know at this point about the link between violence and violent video games? For example, so many heartbreaking mass shootings in America, are most of the mass shooters people who play violent video games?
So there's been massive amounts of research on this, as you might imagine, and going back some decades at this point. And Josh is going to chime in on this too. But to the best we can see, there is no direct causal association between video games of any kind, even first-person shooters and so on, and then direct acts of violence or aggression in the real world, in our physical world. So there have been multiple studies that look at this across different ages and across different genders and in different settings. And, you know, they just can't find a direct kind of link between those two things. Because I'm especially interested in gender, I'm especially interested in kind of the ways that games either foment or exacerbate kind of existing inequities in terms of gender-based violence. And there's a lot of research on that too. And the one thing we can say about that is that people have been looking at this and paying attention to this for a very long time. So not just over the last 10 years, but there have been some, kind of groundbreaking studies of this going back to the late 80s, early 90s as well. There is certainly more experience of online violence and harassment. So people being threatened with all kinds of direct rape, sexual assault, and so on in online spaces that's disproportionately experienced by people who are playing online as women or femme characters in some way. So that is very documentable. But in terms of its kind of migration then into the physical world, that we haven't been able to find a direct causal link. Josh, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. So in 2020, the American Psychological Association said that mass shootings should not be attributed, real world violence should not be attributed to video games. And I think that that's a really kind of powerful statement that runs counter to a lot of the cultural discourse. I think it's totally reasonable that in the aftermath of a horrifying event of that kind, people clamor for any kind of justification or explanation for why the act might have occurred. And video games have long been a sort of steady presence in that cultural discourse, but that doesn't mean that it's an accurate presence. I think one of the things that happens is it gets conflated, the fact that, for example, someone could get very frustrated playing a video game and then they turn off the game and they're still frustrated. But also that's true when you think of your favorite novel that makes you cry. You put down the novel and it and you still feel sad afterward. You listen to your favorite album and you're excited for the next 20 minutes afterward. And so that seems undebatable or beyond question, I think, that a video game makes you feel things. But then the question is, going beyond that, does that become a kind of ingrained pattern that leads to an increase in violence? I think that that has not been found by definitively by any particular study.
Calling in now is our friend Janet McKenney, retired director of library development at the Maine State Library, who is an avid video gamer. Janet, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for asking me. I love video games. It's really interesting to listen to your guests today, and I agree with so much that they are saying.
And I
based
love
on my
Janet.
Long period.
Yeah. So, you know, and I love the fact that you're a librarian. So you are not an either or kind of person. There are video games and books in your life.
Definitely. Definitely. Probably more ebooks than the physical book, but, you know, I still hang on to physical books. But yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of librarians in the video gaming space. In fact, it, you know, may be leaning towards a majority, especially with current librarians now.
Well, let me ask you, I've always known that you love video games and that you especially love Zelda, but I want to ask you how it all started. When did you become a video game player and what do you get out of it?
So, you know, I think very early on, you know, my family, I'm the oldest of seven, we got an Atari, you know, so it started with like Pong. And so, you know, that's almost 50 years ago for me. I hate to even admit it. But I think when the Nintendo Entertainment System came out and my son was of that age, we invested in one of those. And, you know, he was a little on the young side, but super interested because I think he had a friend who had one. So we ended up playing together. And so I think the adult game that I played with my siblings on that system was Metroid, but with my son, it was Top Gun and the original Legend of Zelda, which was great. So we played together. I mean, he certainly played on his own, but I just remember for Top Gun, he could never get to, you know, get the fuel into the plane, you know, while the plane was flying. And so I'd hear him say, you know, mom, come help me. You know, I'm running out of fuel. And so I could like line up and fuel his plane and go. And so it was really kind of a collaborative. So, you know, he sucked me into his games by, you know, needing some help. And also, you know, I enjoyed it so, so very much.
What games are you currently playing, Janet?
So I'm still doing Tears of the Kingdom. I'm having a hard time. You know, I keep putting off defeating the last boss, Ganondorf, because, you know, then I know the game is going to be over, you know. But I'm doing that, and I'm also Hogwarts Legacy, so it's a tie-in to the Harry Potter books. And so it's a very complex game, and, you know, tons of spells and, you know, paths and maps. And, you know, I'm really into quest games and maps and, you know, getting to an end goal, or at least mini end goals, you know, throughout the game. I'm, you know, much more interested in that than probably the arcade type games like Mario Kart or things like that.
All right. I'm going to ask if either of my academics has a question for you. It looks like Rebecca wants to ask you something, Janet.
Yeah, Janet, thank you so much for calling. I'm thinking about libraries as places for access to video games, especially for Mainers who have slow or no internet connectivity and would like a way to access. I know at our local library, shout out to Lewiston Public Library and everybody who works there, they offer games, especially for teens who can come in and play. I don't know if you'd like to say anything about libraries as places to gather and play.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because, you know, and again, it varies from library to library. You know, some of them lend systems, some of them have systems there, some of them lend games. A lot of them have clubs for kids, you know, ton of like Minecraft clubs or, you know, or special programs, especially during, you know, some of the breaks. I went to one, my local library is the Baxter Memorial Library in Gorham, and they did a Zelda Tears of the Kingdom kind of meet up and sharing, and it was great. I obviously was the oldest person there and, you know, talking to 10 and 11 year olds, but it was amazing that we could share things and that we could teach each other things. And I was like really excited, you know, talking about something that I did in Zelda, and, you know, the 11 year old was, "Oh, wow, I didn't know you could do that. Thanks so much. I can't wait to try that." Of course, everybody had their system. So then, you know, he kind of slid away and went to try out what I told him about. But yeah, libraries are a great place. And, you know, clubs borrowing games or utilizing what they may have on site.
Janet, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to look forward to having you back on Maine Calling for a Tech Talk show in a few weeks. Janet McKenney, avid video gamer and former director of library development with the Maine State Library. I'm going to go to Ellery, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for another very interesting program. Quick comment or statement, story, rather. Years ago, I played a solitaire computer game, and I found myself wanting game after game after game until I could win, and I never did. So that was my first and last. So I'm wondering, are games that are sort of addictive, is there a positive side to being drawn into a game and keep practicing, practicing, practicing? Is there a skill or something to be acquired? Is there a positive side to being addicted to a game?
Thank you, Ellery, for that question. And Joshua, I want to ask Ellery's question, which is there a positive side? But I think we maybe ought to talk about addiction a little bit as well. But go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that games develop skills. One of the things that, like, there's some really, really interesting articles about how games are really helpful in helping you organize tasks, right? And so we even saw this with Janet, that there are so many things going on in games. I think she was talking about Hogwarts Legacy at that point, that you actually have to systematize and organize those different tasks in your head. And one of the things that often happens is people ask you what you're doing in a game, and you have to kind of go on and on and on to explain yourself. And so I think that that kind of dedication to a game can be incredibly valuable. But also, I mean, to the broader thing about video game addiction, it is true that if you do something for many, many hours at a time, it probably is not going to be particularly good for you, no matter what that thing is. But it's also useful to put a little bit of history behind that kind of conversation, in that the language about video game addiction sort of started in the 1970s and into the 1980s, when arcades kind of came into being as places for young people to socialize. And arcades were dark and they were loud, and often they were quite gendered as well. They were spaces of sort of like masculine prowess in a gaming space. And they were spaces that older adults didn't necessarily understand or feel particularly welcome in. And there was a concern about kids spending their lunch money playing video games, or spending all their allowance playing video games. And that's really when you start to get the language of addiction emerge. That's when it starts to emerge. And so it's useful to think about then the way in which ideas about particularly video game addiction are tied up with a kind of anxiety that older people might have about this activity that they view as quite unfamiliar, that can be quite exploitative at times, but is certainly not universally exploitative. And then that provides a kind of bigger context to understand why that language about addiction gets associated so deeply with video games as a particular medium.
I might just add, I appreciate Ellery's question so much, that there is something that users need to be keeping in mind, which is the connection between real money and these online spaces. And game developers have been really creative in developing ways for us to spend more and more money while we're in these online spaces, through customizable avatars, through special battle passes and things like that. But one that researchers are paying special attention to are what are called loot crates or loot boxes that have a sort of sensory experience, very much like a slot machine in a casino, and tend to ring the bells in your kind of pleasure centers and similar ways. And so there's a recent paper out from some folks at Harvard showing that most of the money that these games are making from those loot crates or loot boxes are coming from just a few users that they call whales, who are like have gambling addictions essentially and are spending real money in these spaces. So to Ellery's question, I do think that's something that, you know, we all need to be paying attention to.
Ellery, thank you so much. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the world of video games. My guest, Josh Rubin with Bates College. He will teach anthropology at Colby starting next month and has a book coming out about video game development called Feeding the Loop. And Rebecca Herzig studies the history of science and technology. She teaches at Bates College and is co-editor of the book series Feminist Technosciences. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Before the break, Josh, Rebecca was talking about ways in which developers are trying to monetize their games. And you wanted to jump in, but I didn't let you because we had to go to a break. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think I completely agree with everything that Rebecca was saying about loot boxes, that they're this kind of like inbuilt gambling mechanic that a lot of studios have deployed quite successfully in order to take advantage of people who are kind of like drawn to that sort of experience. But at the same time, I think it's useful to raise the point with your listeners that for example, spending money, actual real money, on a customizable avatar may not be the kind of wasted expense that people might think. There's kind of a built-in assumption that money spent in a virtual world is less valid, perhaps, than money spent in a material world. When in fact, there's a lot of studies that show that if you're developing an avatar, if you're developing a character in a virtual space, that can actually be quite validating and quite fulfilling, especially if the body that you inhabit may not be, in fact, the way that you identify. And so the money that people are spending in order to customize their avatar may, from the outside, look like wasted money. That's not a real outfit you get to wear. Why are you spending money on that? But in fact, it's a way of expressing yourself in a virtual space that matters quite a bit to you. And that may be, in fact, money much better spent than the money that you, for example, put to an article of clothing that you have to wear to a wedding that you'll never wear again, right? Or something like that.
We have a bunch of emails here. I'll go to this one first. This one's from John. I'm just wondering, while popular, it's my perception that VR, virtual reality, is not as ubiquitous as I thought it would be in its early days. Do you think VR gaming will be as common as console or PC gaming? Rebecca?
Yeah, I actually dug into this a little bit in preparation for the show, and it turns out that the Generation Alpha, you know, the newest up-and-coming generation, is playing virtual reality or augmented reality games just much more than any of the rest of us. So to John's question, I do think it will be moving up through the generation as they kind of as they get older, and then they start teaching their kids or younger kin and whatever about it. So yeah, I think it's coming. It's just for us oldsters, maybe not as common as it might have been by now.
So Generation Alpha is what's coming after Gen Z.
Yes, the terms kind of get used interchangeably, but yeah, the younger set, they are playing in these virtual spaces more. More than mobile, more than console gaming. They're increasingly turning to these immersive worlds.
Turning to Marfine on Facebook, my six-year-old nephew who lives out of state has started playing video games, and it's a great way for us to connect. As a gamer who plays survival and MMORPG games, is that MPorg or something like that?
Well done.
I know that the gaming community is diverse, but some games skew far right, and kids can expose me to toxic and hateful language from the people they might consider role models because they're older. So I agree with your guest, supervise and lean into educational moments. So Josh, have you seen this sort of like hateful language?
Yeah, I think Rebecca raised this point a little bit ago that one of the biggest concerns I would say by far is when an unsupervised young person is going into an interactive space with other people who are socialized into using horrific language with each other, threatening language, doing awful things to each other in a virtual space. And so that's why I think, again, to the question posed or the comment raised, that supervision is vital, right? You don't, I think Rebecca can say a little bit about this too, but there's an increasing trend in people playing with their microphones off and the audio off, precisely because the space, because of the tone of their voice, because of their accent, any little kind of marker of difference in that kind of space becomes a sort of vector for targeting and hate speech. And so I think there are ways that one could play in a kind of collaborative space that aren't alienating and isolating, but it is something that is a major problem. And in fact, it's also a thing I think that studios can address and have not. They are the ones who provide the infrastructure. They are the ones who can create the system of regulation, and many of them haven't. And I think it harms everyone that they haven't.
I'm going to go to Maria, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Maria. Go ahead.
Hi. I was really struck by a question that Jennifer had asked earlier, which is, what are young people doing instead if they're going to be playing on video games? I'm a children's book author, and I interact a lot with librarians, with educators, with teachers, and with young readers. And what I'm hearing is that kids are not reading nearly the way they used to. A book, The Anxious Generation, by Jonathan Haidt, does a deep dive into this, produces a lot of data about this and the effect of screen time on developing brains. And I wonder what your guests say about that particular book and about that phenomenon.
Rebecca.
Thank you for raising that book. I'm a big fan of that book, actually. And my students at Bates would be the first to tell you that I, as much as I can with respect to accommodations for disabilities, I ban screens in my classroom just so we can all be in one place together. So I'm familiar with the arguments in The Anxious Generation, and I'm empathetic with the arguments in that book. But I also, I guess, to Josh's earlier observation, it's about the how. So if you're sitting and reading with your kid, you can kind of invite and encourage that ongoing reading. If your kid is watching you scroll through your phone, they're probably going to want to be doing the same thing because they're modeling kind of adult behavior on those examples. So I think parents who are concerned about how their kids are spending time can think about it a bit holistically. What's going on in our household? What's going on if the kid is moving between households and the other households? How to have conversations with the kid around that? So it's child-centered rather than simply like parentally imposed. Thou shalt not play. Thou shalt not want screens. Thou shalt not want to talk to your friends about what's on screens, but to kind of make that that broader conversation. I should add on that, though, that Josh and I have been kind of promoting more supervision, more interaction, and so on. But there are a number of sociologists who have observed that with kids in the home spending more time on screens and so on, there's more labor for parental supervision falling on the people in the home who traditionally have had to do that work, which is disproportionately the moms, right? So it becomes another way to build kind of inequitable parental labor inside of households. And that's worth paying attention to. If you can throw them all outside and have them run around, you can get a minute to yourself, you know, to rest or something. And so there's a shift there.
Thanks, Maria. We're going to try to squeeze in a couple more calls. Go to Jennifer calling from Freiburg. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about Common Sense Media. You mentioned that it was a great resource for parents, but I wanted to share my experience. I actually would look at Common Sense Media with my daughter when she was about 6 or 7, and we would make decisions about movies and other things that we wanted to access. Together, and I taught her how to use that as a tool, and then she would come to me and say, I looked up Common Sense Media, and it said this, and so I think it's something we could watch or play. And so I think using that, we would also talk about things that you mentioned, about whether someone said it was violent, but then they might talk more about why they thought it, that they define violence, and then we would decide, do we think the same or not? And she would often say, yeah, I think it's not right for me. So,
Jennifer, I really appreciate that advice. Thank you so much. I'm going to move on to Alan calling from Newcastle. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I had to call in hearing this topic. I'm 57 years old. My son is now 25. He moved out during COVID, and I was dealing with empty nest syndrome. And he suggested getting involved in an online game with him as a way to interact. You know, you got the voice chat. So I started doing Final Fantasy 14 online, and it's been the most wonderful experience. I have this online community of people. It's all our escape. A lot of what some of your people were sharing about the avatar and the investment in the avatar. Like, we have online housing. One of the reasons to keep logging into this game is, like, every 45 days you got to go into your house, you're going to lose it. And you can build these wonderful spaces. It's such a wonderful creative outlet. It's been a social thing. And the concerns that people have about the social aspect has been self-policing. The community is wonderful.
Alan, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience. Guys, we just have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to leave some time to ask you what your favorite games are. So, Josh, I'm going to start with you, either present or past.
Wow. Okay, that's such a big question. I'm playing a game with my daughter right now called Melody of Moomin Valley. It's a game based in the world of Moomin Troll and Moomin Troll's family. It's a Norwegian children's book series, and it's just the coziest, sweetest, most wonderful thing. And it really resonates with a previous caller who said, a child would say, like, I'm stuck here, solve this puzzle for me, because that's what my daughter does. She sits and she plays, and it has plenty of text. She reads the text as she goes along, and it's just the coziest, sweetest, most wonderful thing. And when things get tough, she hands it over to me.
You're out of time, Rebecca.
Because the world is complicated, I tend to gravitate towards ones that mellow me out a bit. So two I enjoy in that way are Unravel, where you play as a character called Yarny, that is just actually does what it says. It just unravels over time as you move through like a natural landscape. And the other that a friend at work has turned me on to is Power Wash Simulator, where you get to, you know, just what it sounds like, spray clean things. That is like weirdly satisfying for folks who remember popping those little packing bubbles and finding that a little bit calming. I think Power Wash Simulator is sort of the online equivalent of that. So.
Isn't that interesting? So just things to zen out. Zone out. That's right. Well, boy, you guys, this has been so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us. Rebecca Herzig, a professor of gender and sexuality studies at Bates College, and Josh Rubin with Bates College soon will be at Colby College teaching anthropology. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Special thanks to Dan Works. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And you can find all sorts of things, including every past show, and a way to sign up for Maine Calling's weekly newsletter at mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the program, an update on the impacts of last year's historic storms, both in western Maine and along the coast. Also, we'll be talking about the lessons they've taught us about storm preparedness for the future. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.